Hello, this is Mark Steiner. Welcome, everybody, here to the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on the Real News Network. We're about to talk to Katrina Vandenhoevel, who's publisher of The Nation. She and Stephen Cohen, contributing editor to The Nation, did an extensive interview with Edward Snowden in Moscow. And Katrina, welcome. Good to have you back.
Thank you, Mark.
So this was, to me, a fascinating interview on many levels. First of all, you began this conversation about him and his life in Moscow. I'm curious just what you took away from that. Maybe we didn't see in the article about his life in Moscow. I know that in the new film Citizen Four, that's a big piece of what goes on. So I'm very curious, what did you walk away with?
Walked away with someone who's very thoughtful, very engaging, quick to laugh in interesting ways, has a lot on his mind, but does not like talking about himself. I mean, that's
right.
Not just, he doesn't like to talk about his life in Moscow. He just feels it's more sort of trivialities compared to the enormous issues he wants to talk about. So it took us, the interview ran 33,000 words. What ended up in The Nation is a hefty 9,000. But we did push a little. One of my favorite parts of the interview is where he talks about going into computer stores in Moscow and he's recognized. They say, hi, Ed. And that he's watching American television. He's watching the Game of Thrones. He's watching Boardwalk Empire. He's watching House of Cards. And he set up a studio. He says he's not a TV whiz, but he does have the equipment that allows him to communicate with the world, which he cares a lot about. Communicate with the, you know, he comes into, beams into South by Southwest or TED Talks. He was awarded the Ridenour whistleblowing award by the National Institute in April, beamed into the National Press Club, has testified to the German Parliament. So he's not, as he said, when asked, you know, what he would advise a young man or woman in terms of the risks he took and what has happened to him, he's aware that someone like Chelsea Manning isn't able to walk the streets of anything. And while he doesn't feel very at home in Moscow, he's kind of not interested in engaging with the city or really the politics of the country. He's there, but he's free to move around.
A lot of people who listen to The Real News, read The Nation, listen to our program, may take something for granted, but a lot of people who are listening do not, or watching, which is that here we have Edward Snowden in Moscow. You talked about his being in Moscow. And the conversation he had on camera with Putin, that a lot of the people who even support Edward Snowden kind of question why he would do that. Why would he have this conversation that was like a setup by Putin, even though the question he asked. He had an interesting conversation with him about that.
Yeah, we did. I mean, part of this, I think, to step back a moment, Mark, is I think a lot of people don't understand that Edward Snowden isn't living in Moscow of his own choice. His passport was revoked by the U.S. government as he flew from Hong Kong to Russia, thinking he would be in transit. And his hope was to fly to Latin America, Bolivia, Ecuador. There were even journalists, if your listeners remember, who were live tweeting the plane he was supposed to be, the plane he was supposed to be taking to fly to Havana to get to somewhere in Latin America. He regrets now having participated in Putin's press conference of earlier this year. This is a press conference Putin does annually. And he, Snowden says in our interview, God, that blew up in my face. What he had hoped was that he could confront Putin as he would have liked to confront National Director of Intelligence James Clapper and ask Putin, hey, you're surveilling, you know, thousands, millions of Russians. Can you admit that to your people? Didn't work out. And so he speaks of the regret. But more deeply, I think what's happened, which personally as someone who's studied Russia, as has my husband, Stephen Cohen, for many years, been going there for more than 30 years, it's a tragedy that Snowden has become a kind of pawn, in a sense, in a relationship, the U.S.-Russian relationship that is at its worst point in 30 years, as you know and your listeners know. I mean, this has been described as a new Cold War. So there he is. But he's not engaged. He's not engaged in the politics. And he's able to find his own life and engage with the outer world and participate in projects like this Magna Carta for the Internet he's working on with Tim Berners-Lee, who's considered one of the fathers of the World Wide Web.
You know, I guess there are a couple of things here. I mean, just to stay with Russia for a moment, because so many people that I talk to about this will always say, well, wait, you know, He's in Russia. He was in Hong Kong. They must see everything's on his computer. They must be using this information against the United States. Yes, I like what he did. I like the fact that he exposed the surveillance against our citizens. But who is he really working for? I mean, I think there's a lot. You know what I'm saying?
There's absolutely. I mean, you just, you know, China, Russia, especially in these times. I'm not an expert on technology, on encryption. Snowden really prides himself on being a kind of philosopher and practitioner of encryption, of knowing the technology, working in the belly of the beast. Laura Poitras, the very fine journalist whose documentary Citizen 4 has come out in the last few weeks, also is someone who prides herself on encryption. They speak as to how Snowden sent on his files and that the Russians nor do the Chinese have access to this. And I would turn to them. I would read what they have written. I would read what Snowden has written with some detail as to why it's not in his hands and they don't have access to it, they being the Russian or Chinese government. But, you know, for those who want to believe, they will, you know, invoke national security. Yet even the, you know, the current head of the CIA has said the sky isn't falling. The president's own review panel, and we talk about this in the interview, has said they have not found any breaches of security that have led to danger and breach of national security for the American people. So there's a lot of hysteria, and Snowden talks of the Sunday talk shows where, you know, they've essentially, some of them have called for a high-tech lynching of Edward Snowden or called him a traitor or called the journalist Glenn Greenwald an accomplice to treason. I mean, this is a lot of talk which produces some of the fear-mongering we have seen, but doesn't contribute to more national security.
One of the things that really struck me about this interview that you did with him was towards the end of the interview that you printed in The Nation, where we talk about Daniel Ellsberg and Chelsea Manning, and it seems as if Edward Snowden kind of, like many of the others, like Daniel Ellsberg, kind of grew into understanding something was amiss.
Yeah.
Like it has to come from the inside to come out for any of this ever to happen. It can't be like somebody exposing like you or me and as a journalist, but as somebody from the inside working on these intelligence operations, something happens and clicks.
Yes.
And that seems...
No, it's very, very interesting. I mean, in some ways, in a curious way, Edward Snowden is, you know, a very traditional, patriotic American who believed, and listen, I work at a place, we're very patriotic, but I've worked with people, and, you know, let me step back. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, used to call every year for the abolition of the CIA. I work with people who believe many of these intelligence agencies should be abolished.
Right.
Edward Snowden believes in surveillance. What he doesn't believe in is mass, illegal, unlawful surveillance in violation of a constitution he believes he swore an oath of duty toward. So when he's in the belly of the beast and he sees what's happening and he tries to go through channels to express his outrage or concern about a violation of the Constitution and nothing happens, he has predecessors, and that's why Daniel Ellsberg is someone he values. Not only Daniel Ellsberg, but he cites Thomas Drake, William Binney. There are others who have come forward, and the expression has blown the whistle or been whistleblowers to expose abuses of the Constitution. Interestingly, Snowden said in our interview, he doesn't love the word whistleblower.
Right.
Because he believes it otherizes you. And while he very much admires Daniel Ellsberg and these others, he thinks that Americans, ordinary Americans, not just heroic Americans, should call it as they see it if they believe constitutional violations are occurring. So there's something quite traditional and conservative about an Edward Snowden, which has been lost in the hysteria or sensation about this. I found very moving, if I might, Mark, another part where my husband, again, who has been a student of Russian Soviet history, taught it for many years, in listening to Snowden, and he was really found Snowden fascinating and thoughtful for such a young person, but also he, Steve, had only seen some of the big interviews and found Snowden, thought he might be a little arrogant.
Uh-huh.
He's not. But then Steve says, you know, you remind me of Andrei Sakharov, who was...
Oh, I remember. That's a great part, yes.
Yeah, who was a co-founder of the Soviet hydrogen bomb, someone who became one of the Soviet Union's most famous dissidents, was exiled to Gorky outside of Moscow. But he, Sakharov, was someone who was very much part of the system, but also saw abuses being committed, violating a constitution he believed was the law of the land. So he too spoke out, and he became a dissident, an other thinker, and he suffered for that for many years, as did his wife, Yelena Bonner. And, you know, it's interesting, Snowden hadn't really heard of Sakharov. You know, there's nothing to say there, except he had heard of the prize given in Sakharov's name, but what it prompted in Snowden was a very interesting reflection on drawing a parallel between what the atomic moment meant for physicists like Sakharov or Robert Oppenheimer, an American dissident, and for the computer engineers, the technologists who work on surveillance, what they have unleashed in the politics and the system, he felt was akin in certain ways to the atomic moment for physicists, and had unleashed a set of anxieties and a lot of conscience in people like Bill Binney, who had been the architect of a program that he later wished he had not given to a system,
right,
which in his view
right.
had been amok.
You know, I was thinking there's a piece in here, and the piece, I just want to read it, where Snowden's response to you saying, the surveillance revelations are critically important because they reveal that our rights are being redefined in secret by secret courts that were never intended to have that role without the consent of the public, without even the awareness of the majority of our political representatives. I mean, so what he's laying before the American people here, I think, is what the country is wrestling with right now.
Exactly. It's a fundamental question about what does a representative democracy mean? And if people don't have the information they need to know what the government is doing in their name, how can they take action? How will change come about? And he really believes that he's given people the information they need. He doesn't see people. He's realistic. He understands that people have other concerns, that they're not in the streets about these surveillance revelations. But he does see a shift, particularly in Europe, and people responding to these abuses in ways he had hoped they would. He is interesting about President Obama. We're here on the eve of the midterm, and President Obama has, of course, factored in and figured into this midterm in many ways. But, you know, he says he didn't release
right.
these revelations before November 2008. He had hopes that President Obama would fulfill and be held accountable to the promises he had made on the campaign trail to disclose and end the torture, to remedy the abuses which had been launched under President Bush and Vice President Cheney after 9/11. He became increasingly disappointed, and he feels that President Obama, this is Snowden's personal view, the greatest disappointment he has less to do with the economic, social legacy of President Obama's administration or time as president, but more the fact that Obama had that famous line, you know, we're going to keep moving, we're going to move forward, we're not going to look back. But it's very hard to move to a next chapter without understanding the previous one. And that is very deeply embedded in Snowden's analysis of what he feels of problems and the frustrations he has with an American political system.
So let me take this a little digression, because I was thinking about this as you were just speaking, and also what you and Stephen wrote in the interview, when Snowden says that he thought that President Obama, I forget the exact words, I can find them in a moment, but was scared of the intelligence agency, was wary of them.
Yeah.
And I'm curious what you make, A, of that statement, and B, what your own analysis is, in all these years of covering this, about what happened with President Barack Obama around this whole intelligence
question. Well, that's a mark. We can maybe take up 42,000 radio shows. That is a big question. But, you know, the question of President Obama being fearful of the intelligence community, it links to something else we spoke to Snowden about, which is the deep state. The deep
right.
state, which Snowden says, I have seen right. it. And it's something you've talked about, you know, Bill Moyers talks about. It's something that is like the permanent campaign. This is what stays. It's entrenched. It's metastasized post 9/11 with the kind of national security contractor surveillance state. These people don't go home. Presidents come and go. Now, I'm not a paranoid. There is the possibility of leadership. There's the possibility of change through leadership, elected, and social movements. But boy, is this a tough system. And I do think President Obama came in. I think there were missteps. You do confront an intelligence community, which is probably saying, listen, if another 9/11 happens on your watch,
it's your fault.
And so the grave mistake is that we haven't managed to learn to live with a measure of threat, that we've so militarized it that the intelligence community has become ever more powerful. And it's not new. I mean, again, Snowden speaks of how, you know, Nixon taped one room. It's a little bit of an understatement. And, you know, look what happened. And now, the whole country's being tapped in collusion with some of these corporate telecom companies. And what's happening? So it speaks to both the democratic system, the end of accountability, but also how the system has metastasized. And he's very, he is very critical of President Obama, but there's no question that 9/11, as your listeners may know, you do too, was a turning point for him. You know, he wanted to enlist and go fight in Iraq. He was injured with broken legs, I think. But he sees the toxicity of what Bush and particularly Cheney seeded in our system. And he had hopes, as so many of us did, that we could make a pivot away from that. He doesn't see that now, but he does see the possibility of reforms coming through technical means. I mean, he's very keen on that. I'm not sure exactly if that's the case. And I also think, and Steve and I push him, he's a little disingenuous when he keeps saying, I'm not a political animal.
Right. He was backpedaling from that a lot. No, yeah. I'm not.
Yeah.
Right. I want to come to that. Just another piece of speculation just for a moment, because it made me think of this as I was reading the article, and I'm very curious what Snowden thinks, what other people think, what you think. You know, when we talk about what President Barack Obama did not do and what Snowden released, revealed to the rest of us, and I talk to congressmen about this all the time. I can never get a really straight answer. But what would really happened if President Barack Obama did put Dick Cheney on trial, did investigate Dick Cheney, if that actually happened, both politically, inside the intelligence community, politically between Republicans and Democrats, progressives, conservatives, and liberals? I mean, it would have been
There would have been a civil war. The media would have contributed to it in different ways. But there were other steps. I mean, President Obama did say we're going to end the torture regime, but there could have been more disclosures, Mark. I mean, you didn't need there's something between putting Dick Cheney on trial and the fact that we still have not seen to this day the CIA Senate intelligence. The Senate intelligence report on the CIA.
Right.
That is a scandal. And the fact that you have an intelligence community pushing back so hard against that committee and its chair, let's be honest, Senator Dianne Feinstein has been a supporter of the intelligence community. When she stepped up and stood out and said enough, and her staffers were being harassed or surveilled, she understood something about this deep state and how they're going to protect their own. So I think there are intermediate steps, which even those haven't been taken. And that's, I think, part of the grave disappointment.
You know, one of the things that in this piece that you talked to him about, you have this great clip when you talk to him about what happened in the Church Senate Committee. And in that here, he talks about the Garden of Liberty and protecting our liberty.
And so when we think in the context of the last decade's infringements upon personal liberty, and the last year's revelations, it's not about surveillance. It's about liberty. When people say, I have nothing to hide, what they're saying is my rights don't matter. Because you don't need to justify your rights as a citizen. That inverts the model of responsibility. The government must justify its intrusion into your rights. If you stop defending your rights because you go, well, I don't need them in this context, or I can understand this, that, or the other, those are no longer rights. Right, the concept of that as a right, whatever it was, you have ceded. You know, you've granted that as a privilege now to the government that can be abrogated at their convenience. And that has diminished the measure of liberty within a society.
And that was pretty moving. I mean, in the sense that he's wrestling with what this meant in a larger sense for him and for the rest of us.
Yes. He's, you know, as I said, he's a real constitutionalist, and he's a believer that there were terrible excesses and that at least with the church committee, you had some measure of accountability. But since then, we've just seen erosion of those rights. But if people give up their rights, that means part of the end of fighting for that Garden of Liberty. And he's trying to explain why, you know, freedom from surveillance is a fundamental civil liberty. And unless you understand that, you're at risk of ceding, of giving up your rights to those who might well abuse them.
So, you know, when one of the things that really hit me, I'd never thought about before or never read about before, really, or maybe I just didn't pay attention, didn't see it. But when you asked him about these times of the troubles that we're facing in the world and in America, one of the things he said was that in the wake of all these surveillance revelations, rushed through laws, other countries rushed through laws,
yes,
that were basically ghostwritten by the National Security Agency to enable mass surveillance without court oversight. Now, what does that mean? I mean,
he's very consumed, and we didn't make this as clear as we might have, with what's going on in New Zealand, Australia, in Britain, this sort of circle of four or five countries, and the erosion of rights there. Even worse in some cases, because there's less of a Bill of Rights, a legal framework for privacy, for protection of these rights. So he sees his revelations both playing a role in sparking change. Some countries, for example, Germany, as you know, is very much involved now in trying to pass through a set of laws in the new year that will restrict surveillance. But other countries do have these kinds of these. They could be written by their own intelligence agencies. They're so permissive in terms of what can be done in the name of security to spy, to surveil people.
I'm speaking with Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. We'll be right back with Katrina VandenHeuvel. And on our way to break, we're hearing Frederick by Patti Smith, which she wrote about her husband, guitar player Fred Sonic Smith, who passed away on this day in 1994. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's I Second That Emotion, the great Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, released on this day in 1967. And I'm speaking with Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation, about the interview she and her husband, Stephen Cohen, who's contributing editor to The Nation, did with Edward Snowden. So when you see Edward Snowden talking about wanting to not be known as an activist, not to take this role of a public spokesman, which he's become despite that, but seeing himself more as organizing around technocratic issues, What did you take away from that?
We kept pushing back.
You did. You did.
He does say, I have a sneaky way of making change or making
right.
change, because he's not going to confront the powers that be head on. But he does see and kind of admits that technical changes are political changes. And so the idea of finding digital rights or, you know, building out a system of internet governance that can be protected despite national laws is something quite powerful. I'm not an expert on it, but he's very engrossed in this project and working with key people. And it's global. I mean, Brazil is part of it, other countries. So, you know, he also ends in a curiously, you know, reformist way. I'm not sure he's, with all respect, right when he says what, you know, what's missing in Congress is you don't have anyone who really understands technology.
Right.
He may be right, because Silicon Valley and these telecom companies, these companies have become such major forces in our culture and our political and other lives that you need people who understand that. On the other hand, you know, you could get people in there who just want to build out the power of such. I thought the ending was quite moving, because he wanted to, you know, he's known here politically as a quite libertarian force. But he says, you know, I'm not the arch libertarian I've been made out to be. Clearly, he's reading a lot about, you know, how he's portrayed. He says, believe in the rights of women to make their own choices. And I also believe in a basic income
right.
for those who don't have meaningful work, because he sees inequality. And we have an interesting sort of back and forth about Occupy Wall Street, which he believes did not fail My husband and I have an ongoing argument about this because Steve thinks it didn't work out. I say, as Snowden does, that social movements often zigs and zags. It's not a linear thing, but the fact that inequality now is discussed in the ways it is. Of course, we need, you know, the changes that will do something with the staggering inequality. But Snowden really thinks that it made an impact. And that he's thinking those things suggests that he's much more of a complex person politically than the linear, one-sided view, arch-libertarian. Of course, the libertarian community does see in him someone who's taking on an intrusive government, but that doesn't mean he's one point, one note along that spectrum.
We're a representative democracy is the idea, the model. But how did we get there? We got there through direct action. And that's enshrined in our Constitution and our values. You know, we have the right of revolution. Revolution does not always have to be, you know, weapons and warfare. It's also about revolutionary ideas. Mm-hmm. It's about the principles that we hold to be representative of the kind of world we want to live in. And when a given order at any time fails to represent those values, when it works against those values, I think that's the sort of dynamic that we're seeing today. We have these traditional parties that are less and less responsive to the needs of ordinary people. And that's why we see the development of this tribalism. People are going out in search of their own values, and they're going, if the government, you know, or the party or whoever won't address our needs, we will. It's about that step toward direct action, because we talk about what is the response, and we say, well, the response is civil disobedience. But then the state, capital state, says, well, in order to be legitimate civil disobedience, you have to follow these rules. You know, they put us in free speech zones. Mm-hmm. They say you can only do it at this time. Mm-hmm. You can do it at this route. You can't interrupt the functioning of the government. You can't do this, that, or the other. They limit the impact, and they limit the outcomes that civil disobedience can achieve. And ultimately, we have to remember that civil disobedience must still be disobedience if it's to be effective. If we simply follow the rules that a state imposes upon us, when that state is acting contrary to the public interest, we're not actually improving anything. We're not changing anything.
Well, you can see this arc. I mean, he talked about in terms of his own changes inside of when he was working in the Intelligence Committee,
right,
and what's happened to him since. He clearly is still evolving in
exactly.
lots of ways.
Exactly. And that was very interesting. You could almost, I mean, we did spend 4 hours with him. You could almost in that period see his mind at work thinking through new things. And I think if he can continue to, you know, lead a life where he does have access to the outer world and engage with it, he has a very verdant mind, and I think he could play a very interesting role moving forward as these debates are only going to sharpen and intensify.
One of the intense interactions the two of you had with Edward Snowden was around his coming back to stand trial.
Yeah.
Well, not coming back to stand trial. I found that fascinating, and I mean, before I ask something specific, just describe that for us from your perspective, sitting with him, when you and Stephen were sitting with Edward Snowden.
Yeah, he clearly wants to return, but he's aware and he's careful because, you know, he's sitting there with two journalists, editors without legal representation, and he wants to be careful because he would like to find a way back home. But he feels that the misuse of the Espionage Act of 1917, which was designed for other purposes, the use of that in his case, the use of it against journalists, other whistleblowers, has mitigated the chances of a public interest defense, which would be quite something. And Steve keeps pushing back, you know, the idea that they're going to allow you to subpoena various people or documents just doesn't seem in the cards. But, you know, he does speak, and I'm not sure he's right about this, but this is his view, that the elite, the establishment, is basically supporting him. And then he cites The Guardian and The New York Times. I mean, you know, you could also say CBS, NBC, Meet the Press, all of that is also establishment, and
right.
they certainly haven't supported Snowden. But The New York Times called for clemency and called for a way to bring Snowden home, at least to have a fair trial, which is impossible under the circumstances. But he does have a lawyer, ACLU lawyer, who's been very active, a lawyer in Germany. But you can see also how angry he is, because he feels that because he exposed the intelligence community's failures, as opposed to like do a zero dark 30, right, which he talks about, there is great impetus inside that community to push back and to demonize him and to traitorize him. And so that makes a fair trial much more difficult.
Well, when you see, when he sees that Chelsea Manning has this huge long prison term, and
yes,
that even in the day of Daniel Ellsberg, he had to go underground to hide, not to be put into prison. You've got the Sterling, the former CIA
yes,
officer, facing many years. They're going after Risen. So you can see his trepidation about when to come back to stand trial and wondering if it could even be fair.
Absolutely. I mean, the other thing that really, and I wrote a column in the Washington Post a few days after the interview came out called Justice for Edward Snowden. It is a measure of the lack of accountability in our system that the National Director of Intelligence, James Clapper, went to Congress, lied. It is now clear from the record that he lied when asked by Senators Udall and Wyden if Americans were, their data were being collected and spied on. And Snowden looks at the fact that Clapper is firmly ensconced and that he, Snowden, is in exile and may well not find a way to come back, even through trial. And he finds that a measure of a true failure of American, of a system of accountability. And I think he's right. I mean, if there was justice, Clapper would be investigated. As Snowden says, hey, even baseball players.
That was great.
Called up to
right,
Congress
right,
to be investigated. But Clapper would be under investigation, if not more, and there would be a way found for Snowden to come back and at least meet a fair trial, if not some kind of clemency from the president.
Right, and I think that, you know, that with this article coming out, Citizen 4 coming out, I wonder if this is going to create some new conversation, because here we are in November, the trial for Sterling could happen in January, Risen could be brought back into the picture again.
That's right.
You know, I mean, we could be seeing kind of an arc of a national conversation growing out of all of this now.
I hope so, Mark. I think you're going to see more action. I've been in touch with a few people. I think more action in Europe, where there'll be some legislation inspired by Snowden's revelations. Tomorrow, again, is the midterm. One of the key, one of the key senators who's really challenged the NSA, Mark Udall, is in a very tough fight in Colorado. So that's not hopeful. And they're not enough, as you know, you follow this closely, on in the Congress who really want to make this an issue. On the other hand, it is one of the few kind of what I call transpartisan, cross-partisan issues, with a Rand Paul taking it up. But you're not seeing much movement in, I think, really taming the surveillance state. And there's a lot of talk about the abuses, but the key next step is to find real ways through movements and through legislation to make real changes. Or there will be what Snowden is working on, the technical changes. We talk about the iPhone 6. Don't grill me on that.
That was great. Well, I love that part. Don't grill me on that either.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, I was struck a week or so before we knew we were going to do this interview that there were headlines in the newspapers about, you know, post-Snowden revelations, iPhone 6 has encryption. That, you know, so it was kind of linked to Snowden's revelations as if the companies were reacting, and in some ways they are, whether it's for moral reasons, doubt it, but it's for competitive reasons. There's an anger at the government because the companies already gave them, you know, sort of permission, and then the NSA and others even took even more. But, you know, Snowden thinks that, again, you have a kind of created, manufactured crisis by the FBI and some key people in intelligence law enforcement about the dangers of this encrypted phone, because you can still, through like geolocation or through warrants, get the information you need if there's kidnapping or trafficking.
Well, I think this interview brought back to us here is a very important piece of work, and I was looking forward to this ever since it was sent to me. to talk with you about this. And I appreciate the work you do and the work that you and Stephen Cohen did. And I think that it's critical in this next steps of us addressing this issue of what happens to our liberty and what Risen has brought out. So Katrina VandenHeuvel, once again, thank you so much for all
you've done. Thank you, Mark. And thank you for having our correspondents, Norman Solomon and Marcy Wheeler, on to talk about the Risen case, which we also covered.
We're going to have to put a whole nation section on our website.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Take care, Katrina. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.